Is that all right? Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Without strain? I may not be saying anything very intelligent, so don't worry if you miss it. I'm very grateful to Roy for the invitation. It's very nice to be here. I am really an archaeological case study is what I offer you first thing in the morning. It does have some implications for the process of Christianization. It's probably more useful, this occasion is probably more useful to me than to you in many ways, because what I'm doing is trying to publish a site where we've been for 17 years trying to understand a Pictish settlement which appears to have a lot of attributes which we would normally call monastic. So it does seem to be a Christian place in a part of Britain, i.e. the Pictish part of Britain, which is not well known for its Christian manifestations. And the processes of that Christianization are quite poorly understood still. So I think it was probably an expedition which was worthwhile. And now I have to try and present it in the next couple of years as a monograph. And some of the ideas that have been floating about are probably a bit mad and can be corrected. So this seems to be a good opportunity for that to happen. What I'm going to do is very quickly line up some of the aspects, some of the characteristics of this site. Some of them will immediately, I think, you'll find it easy to place them in any kind of early monastic paradigm. And then I want to try and track the sources of these particular attributes, asking questions such as how much of this ritual site is owed to incoming ideas from Ireland and ultimately the Mediterranean, and how much is owed to the pre-existing patterns of thought in northeast Scotland in the Iron Age. And these are good questions to ask, but not very easy questions to answer clearly. So our project set out to try and understand how the... Oh, yes, you're... our project set out to try and understand how the northern Picts entered the Christian community sometime between the 6th century and the 9th. And when we started, we also added the phrase, if they did, that would be 1994 when we began. And the method was fairly simple. We had a survey area of the Firthlands in which we collected up as much information as we could about settlement, whether pre-Christian or Christian, and then we focused on the site of Port Mohammock, which seemed to be promising in the sense of having deposits which were likely to be readable and likely to be of the right period. And this is what one has to do. There isn't another way, but just trying to predict how useful it's going to be. So we did that. And our objectives, once we began to get a feeling that this was a monastic establishment, was to try and understand the layout and to try and understand the economy, try and understand the context. And for all those reasons, we wanted a big excavation. So we were able to excavate about a hectare here outside the church, as well as inside the church and the whole of that. And hopefully that would lead, because this would then act as a local barometer, this would lead to a sense in which alliances and allegiances were changing and ideology was changing in that place, and that in turn would give a broad indication of the movement, the intellectual movement of the northern Pictish king, and that was the home. So very quickly, what we found there was a sequence of churches, a burial ground which stretched from the 6th century through to the 16th. Outside the church there was a workshop area, largely of the 8th century, with some indications of a previous 7th century activity, and a farm, all contained within an enclosure ditch, which was the original definition of the site as seen from the air. So the workshops produced a road, a paved road with curbs, and on one side of that was a vellum working area, which was deduced from these finds and these features. And basically these are proxies, these are items, smooth stones, curvy knives, needles, and pumice rubbers. They are proxies for the activity of making vellum. So we didn't find any vellum, but these seem to be the tools which would go with such an activity. We also found similar indications of the making of precious metal objects. These are moulds, and they are working, certainly working bronze, certainly working silver, arguably working gold. And these objects were scattered around a very interesting building you see there. It's a sort of sporran-shaped building, which was apparently where the metal workers were centralised. I should say the vellum workers had a building of exactly the same shape, although much more battered, therefore harder for me to show them. And there was a water mill, which was evidenced by a pond, culvert, wheel pit, as you see there. A series of burials began in radiocarbon terms in the early 6th century. These radiocarbon dates have to be calibrated as a sequence, and this is being done at the moment. So I think there are undoubtedly dates of the 6th century, but for the moment, we ought to leave the question of, okay, when did it start, to one side. However, the Tarbert Peninsula has a lot of burials on it, including a lot of kist burials, including Bronze Age kist burials. So it is a place which is traditionally a burial ground. It's a peninsula. It's not an island. It's the nearest thing to an island that you've got on the east coast, really. But it does seem to be favoured for a burial, certainly from the Beaker period, arguably earlier than that. The burials associated immediately with the church are these kist burials here with the upright stones and sometimes a floor and sometimes a lid. There's a whole series of grave markers. On this particular picture, on the left-hand side, are some comparative material from Iona and Aileen Neave and other places. And the ones that photographs are the ones that have come from the Port Mahomet site. There are altogether, this is the famous Apostle Stone, a slab taken out of the makeup of the 17th century crypt where it had been reused, as a lot of these stones were. And the total now is around about 235 carved stones, many of them excavated outside the church where they had been hammered into small bits and thrown on the ground as makeup sometime in the early 9th century. This monument can be pieced together by virtue, firstly, of the fact that these are interpreted as apostles, owing to the presence of St. Andrew with his famous haircut, I believe is the way it's done. And if there are apostles, then there are probably 12 of them. If there are 12 of them, they may be in a row. If they're in a row, then it's going to be around about 1 metre something wide. The famous Latin inscription John Higgett wrote about, that fits into this monument as well. As you can tell by the little bit of the corner that it carried on it. And this reconstruction here by Liz Hooper is the form of the cross, which is not a very well-known form, I think you probably agree, but it seems to be the best we can do so far until urged to think differently about it. This is one of a number of cross slabs that have been found in part in the Port Mahomet kirkyard. Here is the church in the middle. This line here is the line of a bank, which you can still see from the air, which might represent some kind of inner precinct. The positions of the slabs are deduced from where they were found in the late 19th or early 20th century, except for number 4, which is simply the presumed position of the presumed cross slab or standing cross from which the 200 odd bits of sculpture that we found outside presumably emanated. And we could look at the peninsula as well as a precinct, as an area marked by its very famous cross slabs. In addition to Port Mahon, of course, we have Hilton of Cadbol, we have Shandwick, we have Nigg. Each of these, a possible exception of Shandwick, have now been moved or displaced in some way, so it's not entirely clear where they stood, even in the case of Hilton, I would maintain. But their geographical positions are on the coast, they are looking out into the sea, they are providing a viewshed, and I do think that they probably therefore are there as an indication of the way into this peninsula. In each case, there is a place to land very close to where the cross slab supposedly stood. And for that reason, I think it's possible anyway that the peninsula there, with its portage, as suggested by the name Tarbert, its portage represents a monastic estate, an estate, a single piece of property, a single piece of land, signalled as such by the Christian community. And at this time, this community is at least has a knowledge of the Pictish symbol system. So insofar as we can label these people, linguistically they're Britons, speaking a pre-Britannic, a pre-Britannic language, and artistically they're the people with the symbols, and that's about all you can say, because the rest of their art is referential both to north and west and to west and to south. So if asked the question, are these Picts, I would say yes. If asked the question, is this a monastery, I would say yes, I think it is. I think this, therefore this is a Pictish monastery. And the area, the larger area of Murray Firth, also sees changes of a kind we're quite familiar with in Anglo-Saxon England, apparently a reordering of the territory which goes between the 6th century and the 9th. And in this case, it's due to a terrible depletion of sites. So we really have so few settlements in Scotland. You've only got to think of the 30,000 that are known from Ireland, and I think we're up to about 6 in Scotland now. So we really don't have the material to argue from when it comes to settlement hierarchies. But we do have these remarkable carved stones, and the ones with incisions, the class ones, as you see on the left in the triangles, are distributed a different way in the landscape to the ones of, which contain images in relief and a cross, in other words, the ones that are thought to belong to the Christian period, and they are very closely clustered along the coastline. And every one of these probably represents a monastery, Port Mahomet being a good example, but one that was, if you like, rediscovered with a certain amount of luck. So we've been extremely fortunate in the past few years in the publication of monastic sites. There have been some absolutely terrific projects and terrific publications. These are just a few examples. And I think these really cumulatively have helped to reawaken the reality, if I can call it that, of the early Christian period in the sort of the Irish Sea area. Well, the agenda that we've got now is to try and work out what these places were. And it's become a habit, I think, to call them monasteries, and why not? I mean, we've got to have some sort of language to talk to each other about. But what I think we're talking about is the polythetic set of these attributes which go with a settlement. If we have a name, that's easy, but if we don't have a name, then we're looking for this kind of gathering of material. And the use of writing and the use of Latin and so on, these things are pretty strong. Other things, I think, are a little bit weaker, like the layout. And in the case of the churches, we don't really have a Pictish church yet, so we've got problems. So what I did was explore some of the new literature and some of the ideas of people writing about this material today, and try and see whether we can get any closer to where these particular attributes might have had their source. And for churches, although we don't have the material in Scotland, I use Thomas of Carrigoyne's thesis and his very interesting conclusions that the typology of churches in Ireland would have not so much a chronological as a regional character. In other words, that the geography of the place is influential in the kind of building produced. Now you may say, well, yes, obviously, common sense. Yes, okay, but the thing is that it does give us the chance to show that there is an influence there on the primary kind of architecture. Writing we have now in Shamanic is a remarkable find, and a lovely report. If you haven't seen it, I do recommend it to you, Chris Lowe's report. They seem to have dug up a school, basically, where children are learning to write on slates, and there's a great big pile of these slates, really the reject pile, where the writing and indeed the drawing wasn't quite up to scratch. And one of these stones has an extract from the hymn Audete Pantes, and therefore Audete Pantes, 7th century hymn, the Adeptus quotation, all helping to locate it as well as to date it as a product of the 7th or 8th century. We have the Tide Mill at Nendrum. It's a fantastic piece of excavation, lovely piece of work, in which very many of the attributes of the mill were preserved, which where they weren't at Port Mahomock, but it's helped us understand what we probably had once. We've had a lot of interesting work on burial, mainly dating kist graves, which have gone earlier and earlier. Really, ever since Joanna Close Brooks pointed out that kist graves couldn't be Christian indicators because they occurred already in the Iron Age, more and more Iron Age versions of the kist graves have turned up. However, I would ask you to look out for Adrian Maldonado's thesis, which should be awarded, I hope, fairly soon. Examined, I should say, from Glasgow. He will probably publish it. He's radiocarbon dated all the burials in Scotland. And even though he has found that kist graves are earlier, there's absolutely no doubt that there is a massive boost to the practice in the 7th and into the 8th century. So like most things, it's good, but it's not quite clear. It's complex. So the practice would have prehistoric roots, but receive a new awakening in that period where Christianization is at its most powerful. Well, as for the layout, people have written very wisely about the layout, and we've all hoped that there would be one which we could all recognise, particularly hopefully from the air, so that we could say, ah, there's another one. I suppose the real difference that is worth noting is now that Mount Weymouth and Jarrow are published, Rosemary Cramp has given her verdict on Mount Weymouth and Jarrow and some of the other Northumbrian monasteries, converging on a kind of cloistral rectilinear layout, preempting the St. Gall plan. Very interesting, massively important in its own right. But of course, a bit of a contrast with the material that we're familiar with in the west and the north, where it's more curvilinear than rectilinear. We in Scotland have always rather hoped to find strong evidence that this circularity had its roots in the prehistoric landscape as well, and it's been harder to do that in Ireland, strangely, where we have the evidence of some 10 years of the National Roads Authority excavations with dozens of superb excavations of early medieval sites. And very, very few of these have turned out to be prehistoric, rather irritatingly. But Camlin, County Tipperary, is one example, which seems to be Bronze Age. This is a Scottish one, Iron Age. And I suppose it's still I think it's still, the jury is still out. We're still thinking about this, but it does seem to be likely, possible, probable, that a curvilinear prehistoric ritual form was available to monastic founders in Ireland and Scotland. Well, numerology is a place where people very wisely never go, and this is our building, and this building has got a beautiful plan, and given sufficiently late hours and lots of whiskey, you can start to imagine all sorts of brilliant mathematical coincidences. And in this case, what I did is I measured all the different distances and then invented the Tarbert foot of 12.5 inches, which conveniently reduced all the distances to whole numbers, which I thought was more than useful, and then took the all the ratios and came up with the ratios here all tending to about 1.6, in other words, the ratio of the golden section. Now, it's not quite as daft as all that. The real question is, I think people, somebody just found the same thing in illuminated manuscripts. It won't be long before I think the same thing is found in sculpture. I mean, they are beautifully symmetrical, and yet they're not quite linearly symmetrical. So I think there will be these kind of relationships. However, the real point I wanted to make is this part of Christian doctrine, or does it have deeper roots, and does it have deeper roots in the thinking, the pre-Christian thinking of the people? Standing stones, obviously, are one of the finest attributes of both Scotland and Ireland. You know them well, but of course they're not new to the landscape. The landscape is already covered in standing stones, doing all sorts of strange things, according to prehistorians. The point is, they're still there, so they would have been there as well in the 6th, 7th, 8th century. And these stones are used to mark territories. Again, Tomas has shown this kind of thing. He also pointed out that prehistoric routeways are being used or reinvented or sanctified in the Christian period, as in his Brandon route. And these are things which people have long suspected, but I think it's been slower to produce good quality evidence. And this is Jerry and Thomas's spatialization of charisma, which I put in just because I love the phrase. And here they are on the Shmari, and they're showing how the edges of the island are marked out with places, which of course also suggest perambulation, suggest certain kinds of a ritual procession. And this is what we've borrowed for the Port Mahomet, for the Tarbert Peninsula. So I think the upshot so far seems to me is if you have a spectrum from fairly local and probably prehistoric roots to quite exotic and definitely sort of coming in with the new thinking from the Mediterranean, you can place these attributes at different points along this spectrum. Church is certainly an imported idea, but they would be adapted regionally. That seems to make sense. Writing, certainly, from the Mediterranean. Iconography, well, the biblical has to be mixed up with the local, although art historians, I think, have been rather reluctant to unpick this or deconstruct it. Watermills must come from somewhere. We still don't really know where. Kiss graves are an adaptation from prehistory, but particularly, I think, favoured in the early Christian period. Their layouts are different in the east and south to the north and the west, and the north and the west has prima facie a link with prehistory. Numerology, who knows, but because these things are in nature, it doesn't seem impossible that they were part of ancient knowledge as opposed to new knowledge. Standing stones, well, they will have had a prehistoric basis, territorial, similar, perambulation, all these things probably belong to a pre-Christian ritual landscape, although it's very hard to find it. Well, three more pieces of lunacy just to finish with. First of all, the cult of relics. Obviously, I'm not the first person to suggest that the cult of relics is not a particularly Christian introduction, as Charles Thomas claimed, or Charles Doherty claimed it a long time ago. I think probably what we have now, which we didn't have before, are some really good prehistoric examples of the reservation of body parts in the service of ancestor worship. I think that's what the cult of relics probably would be described as. We've got good evidence from the Neolithic period. We've got Parker Pearson's excavations here at Clahallan. That's supposed to be examples of relics buried under the floor. And each year brings new suggestions. As people start to look for this, I think each year produces new examples of either skulls or limbs or forearms or bits that have been kept because on account of their virtue. Charles Thomson's quite right about that, I'm sure. The tonsure, Natalia Van Clover wrote a really interesting article a few years back about the tonsure, really mainly gained from art, and her contention was that the tonsure described as Celtic, the non-Roman tonsure, it would derive from images belonging to the Iron Age. These images would go with druids or whatever. They are, that is the contention. It's worth reading the article. And then lastly, the question of Easter, always very contentious. It has its own literature, all bound up in literature. So all I'm doing is not contending any of that. I'm just trying to add another layer of possibilities. Prehistorians have done a lot of work on the calendrical qualities of standing stones, and no less a prehistorian than Colin Renfrew has given his imprimatur to this practice. He doesn't believe in a standardised measurement, but he does believe that these stone circles and so on were calendrical in function, so that at least where they stood, there should have been an understanding of how the seasons are measured. And with that, of course, comes the concept of the equinox. But the equinox is one thing you really can't very easily measure, so it may not have been that they are doing. Nevertheless, every people has a festival associated with the coming of spring, and probably you didn't have to wait for the Christian religion to arrive for that to happen. If that is true, then it's interesting that the distribution of the stone circles is it's not too different from the distribution of the now Anglo-Saxon parts of Britain and the areas of Ireland. So although I'm not supposing for one minute that there is one standardised calendrical formula for these areas, it's interesting that they coincide with the area that for a brief period anyway, wanted to propose a different method of calculating Easter, however much that was rooted in good Mediterranean literature. There is another explanation, of course, which is that this is where the stone circles were because this is where the stone was, and that sort of de-intellectualises that particular particular thesis. Well, just two closing thoughts. The first is that we have, I think, corporately changed our view a lot on how intellectual change occurs and ideological change occurs. There was a feeling in the beginning that since that's where the evidence was, we needed to concentrate firmly on how the missionaries worked and the kinds of explanations that were found effective and so on. And now I suppose in the spirit of the age, we're more interested in the receiving body and what they do, and trying to work out how a particular community in a part of Britain or a part of Ireland would have received the new ideas and the new revelation. That process of reception would clearly have quite a lot of negotiation involved in it. After all, in many cases it would mean that the local authority would have to renegotiate quite a lot of important relationships of power, also ownership of land, also procedures of celebration. All those things in the end can't be achieved without a certain amount of agreement on quite a broad basis, which is why I'm saying here that the local leaders become really important players. If the local leaders become important players, then they are almost certain to adapt the new thinking with its rewards in alliances, they're bound to adapt that thinking to their own region. If they do that, then they're almost certainly going to use what we would call tradition, or at the very least, the deep roots of prehistoric thought. So I go back to my original site now and think how it is that somebody can design a monastic establishment, and how it is that a mason and a sponsor can come up with a standing stone. And I'm bound to suggest that this would involve considerable complexity, and I think that's not a new suggestion. But in addition to the exotic influences, we also have to take into account the contemporary politics, the prehistoric thinking, and particularly, I think, the pre-Christian landscape. Because even if this thinking has not survived the previous 200-300 years or the previous 2-3 generations, the landscape is still there, and that landscape is being rethought by every generation in terms of its own context and its own future. Thank you.